One ingredient of a good life, I think, once again, comes out of Socrates, but you can also find it to some degree in the Buddha. It's that a good life requires one to examine it, to examine what a good life is. So to live a good life is to, in an ongoing way, in an open-minded way, continue to examine the nature of your life. Now, that might sound a little bit redundant, but something happens when you continue to do it as a daily practice. Your life becomes fuller, it becomes richer, becomes more textured. I think it becomes much more vital. So that's at least one component of a good life. And that's what I found each and every day, as one person put it, each and every day a philosophical exercise. So each day you're exercising, thinking about the kind of life you're living, with the idea of it becoming more coherent, more intact, more enfleshed as you continue to do that.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. This episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by 2020, where creatives go to get inspiring, authentic stock photos. If you're tired of scrolling through uninspiring staged images, check out 2020. Their images are crowdsourced from real-world photographers, and you can choose from millions of high-quality photos available under a simple royalty-free license. Today, 2020 is offering Unmistakable Creative listeners a free trial of 5 photos so you can see for yourself. To start your trial, go to 2020.com/unmistakable. That's the word 20, then 20.com/unmistakable to get your first 5 photos for free. Thanks to 2020 for sponsoring today's episode. This episode is also sponsored by HostGator. If you're looking to build a website or move an existing one, HostGator can help. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder. If you're not tech-savvy, and if you want to move your existing website from your existing host, they make it free and simple. Visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 15% off all of their hosting packages. Andrew, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so I was introduced to you by way of our mutual friend Kay, who told me that you have effectively been the equivalent of a chief philosophy officer for many startups in Silicon Valley. And to even have a job title like that, I thought, okay, this is somebody who has a fascinating story. But before we get there, I want to start by asking you, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact has that ended up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Great question. I think I was most certainly an oddball in high school. I was a part of the jocks, but wasn't quite a jock myself. I was also part of the nerdy or more academic types, but wasn't really quite a good member of that group either. Mm-hmm. And so I think that even before high school, my weirdness or oddness was a part of my life story. And so even well after high school and on into college and after graduate school, I just became a bit odder and odder, weirder and weirder, or stranger and stranger.
Mm-hmm. And what impact has that had on the choices that you've made with your career?
Well, what that's meant, I think, is that, well, there's a number of philosophers who've talked about what philosophy is really like, what its starting point is, and from Diogenes the Cynic all the way to a 20th century German philosopher named Joseph Pieper, the idea is that philosophy starts when you begin to think that the things that are self-evident are brought into question. So the things that people take to be as givens, you begin to wonder about. Mm-hmm. And that has been more and more the case for me. After I left graduate school, as I'm sure we'll get into more, I moved to New York City and it wasn't sure how to lead a philosophical life, but I knew it was going to be something that was at a remove from the institutions that I had belonged to. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up starting a philosophy practice and asking these strange and interesting and wonderful questions with the people originally in New York City and then around the world. Mm-hmm. So that sense of weirdness, so that sense that the world is a strange, interesting, and mysterious place began well before high school, and I carried with me well after high school.
Mm-hmm. So these questions, one, you know, what led you to asking these questions? And let's talk about what those questions specifically are, because I think that's really where this gets interesting. Specifically, like, you know, what is self-evident that we don't question at all?
Oh, there's so many things. So one of the big ones is, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
And we ordinarily stop the inquiry. If we start the inquiry, we end up stopping it too quickly. For instance, if I'm simply a member of this family, or I'm simply someone who comes from this country, or I'm simply someone who is married to so-and-so, or I'm simply, more recently, someone who has a certain kind of job or a certain kind of career, I am that. So that's one question. You begin to ask it more and more deeply, and it becomes more and more curious. Mm-hmm. But there are other sorts of questions that I think are even easier to grasp a hold of. One that I've been thinking a lot about is the nature of work today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have taken it as a given today that, as I was reading just yesterday, someone was writing a piece and said, well, given that it's the case that we're going to work most of our waking hours, and given it's the case that's going to occupy a central role in our lives, now what? How do we make it more fulfilling? And I thought, hang on a second. That doesn't have to be so. It doesn't have to be true that we live in what one scholar, Sebastian de Grassi, calls a work society.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have it. It doesn't have to be true that most of your attention is focused on work. It doesn't have to be true that most of your hours of each day are work-related. It doesn't have to be true that your thoughts begin with the idea of being productive and with a question about whether you have been productive. These are all questions that are very alive and well today, particularly as we enter into a period when AI may change the face of work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely want to spend quite a bit of time talking about sort of the changing face of work, but I want to go back to this question of who am I? And one of the things that I've been really wondering about is, when do we draw the line, or where do we find this sort of line between self-reflection and self-obsession? Because I think that, you know, when I have a tendency to self-reflect, it goes from self-reflection into endless rumination of things that could have been done differently, or how things might have done, you know, turned out differently if I'd done this, that, or that differently. And I'm curious, you know, what your sort of workaround philosophy shows about this.
Well, I think there are different ways described. The one described is quite commonplace. It's more of a sense of churning, that I get a question and I start to churn about with it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other ways. For example, when one philosophizes, one begins to find that one asks a question, such as, who am I? And then provides a set of answers, and then investigates some of those answers to see which is the most likely to be true, and then continues in a direction in which, by the end of a philosophical inquiry, you have like, you might call it a provisional answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, I think when we think about philosophy today, when we think about thinking about ourselves, we often think about what you just described, over-analysis, overthinking, getting caught up or wrapped up in ourselves. And I would submit simply that there is another way of thinking that's much more progressive in a way. It actually yields something. It yields something for the process itself.
Mm-hmm. So how do we shift to that progressive way of thinking?
Well, it's going to require that we learn systematic forms of investigation. So when an easier way of putting it is that it happens through dialogue. So we go back to Socrates. Socrates was really quite a marvelous figure, and he saw that if I can get out of my own thinking, you might say, I can get away from being wrapped up in myself if I dialogue with someone else. And if we follow a certain kind of format. And for him, the format involved one person playing the role of the questioner and the other person playing the role of the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption was that if the questioner could ask interesting questions, as you're doing today, then it would solicit from the answer some kind of answer that they can then be investigated further. And they can see whether, through a process of dialogue, they could come to some kind of mutual understanding. That's one way in which I'm not caught up in a lone room by myself, churning about with questions that don't go anywhere.
Right.
Because I've found someone else that I can bounce my ideas off of. I found someone else who's going to confirm or disconfirm, who's going to bring acceptance or maybe even an interesting doubting question to what I've said.
Sure. I mean, it seems to me that that often, you know, comes in the role of like coaches, therapists, mentors, because they're able to give you a perspective that maybe you hadn't considered in the process of trying to find an answer. One that, you know, often, you know, like often our own answers seem disempowering more than empowering.
That's true. I think that there are, and what's interesting about today is that you can look at coaches, therapists, mentors of various sorts, and now, of course, philosophers. All of them are, I think, interested in the process of how someone comes to understand himself or herself by means of some kind of dialogical situation. And then it's going to vary considerably about how they approach the matter.
Mm-hmm. So tell me how you get from this sort of idea of, you know, being a philosopher to turning this into an actual job, where you're consulting with Silicon Valley executives. And also, you know, what role has this played in the lives of people like that? Like we might not even imagine.
Well, it begins with a crisis of sorts. It begins with a moment of despair.
Uh-huh.
It's the winter of 2009, and I've just finished a dissertation about the nature of a good life, a good human life in the modern world, and I'm becoming increasingly disenchanted with the academic life that I've been trained to be a part of. So I'm sitting there, it's a very cold winter in Wisconsin, and I look out of my window, and I see that there is a bird feeder, and the bird feeder is covered with layers upon layers of ice. It happened to be an extraordinary cold winter that year. And I'm just looking at it. I'm spending countless hours looking at this unwavering, still, very cold, very distant bird feeder. And I don't really know what to say at this point, because this is what T.S. Eliot would call an objective correlative. I don't really have the words to say. I'm in despair, and this is a manifestation of that despair. But suffice to say, I realize that I don't really know what I'm doing in my life, and that the way I've led it so far has been largely unreflective. And it's that moment that I begin to start questioning my life at a deeper level, not just questioning things that I've read, not just arguing about the things that I've thought about, but actually introspecting, thinking about my own life. That led me to have an experience of reading someone who really did change my life, and that's the French philosopher Pierre Hadot. He argues that philosophy is a way of life. It's not actually a particular kind of academic pursuit. And so much of what he ends up writing about ends up trying to show us a path, a way of thinking about philosophy that I think is very amenable to the lives we lead today. Mm. So I had the despair. And then I had the meeting, or the reading someone, reading a kind of philosophical guide. And those moments together led me to think that not only should I leave the academic life, it's not for me, but I should also go somewhere else and think about how I could begin to make this life possible.
Mm-hmm.
So there it becomes more of an entrepreneur story, really by necessity rather than by choice. I moved to New York City. I do a lot of gig work over the next couple of years, mainly having to do with teaching people this and that, all sorts of things, while I'm trying to think about how to lead a philosophical life, a life devoted to the loving pursuit of wisdom. And it just so happens that someone points me to philosophical counseling, and it's a very short training, and I think, why not? I sort of do it on a lark. I end up doing it and thinking, well, maybe this is for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up doing the things that most of your listeners are probably familiar with. I start a website. But in addition to having a website and blogging, I was starting to think about all the questions that I think people often take for granted. What am I doing? How am I doing it? With whom? What is the name of the person I would be working with? Are we working? How do we get on? What kind of business model would this be? Would it be a standard business model, or would it be some kind of alternative business model? And these are all kind of questions up in the air. But thankfully, as this was occurring, this is not long after the economic collapse of 2008-2009. So this is about 2011. And at that time, what ended up being very interesting was that people started actually asking larger questions. It wasn't just, I lost my house, or I'm in debt, or I lost my job. It went beyond that, it seemed. People were really searching at that point, and I think have been since. So my launching the philosophy practice, I think, largely coincided with moments of loss that people had been experiencing, and the sense that they didn't really quite know how to live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, I ended up experimenting a lot. I would often have conversations with people in Central Park and Prospect Park, and we would just walk and inquire together. Or we would go somewhere and inquire together. I would meet that person's house, and we would have philosophical conversations. And so it ends up developing in a very organic way, very improvisationally, very much going by my wits and seeing what happens when I do something. And I think that's the standard entrepreneurial piece.
Mm-hmm. This episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by FreshBooks. So the working world has changed, and with the growth of the internet, there's never been more opportunities for the self-employed. And to meet this need, FreshBooks is excited to announce the launch of an all-new version of their cloud accounting software. It's been redesigned from the ground up and custom-built for exactly the way you work. Get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid quickly. The all-new FreshBooks is not only ridiculously easy to use, it's also packed full of powerful features. You can create and send professional looking invoices in less than 30 seconds. You can set up online payments with just a couple of clicks and get paid up to 4 days faster. And you can see when your client has seen your invoice and put an end to the guessing games. Not only that, FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted trial for free to Unmistakable Creative listeners. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/creative and enter Unmistakable Creative in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Two things come from this. What did your dissertation teach you about the nature of a good life? Like, what does that actually mean? How have you seen that applied in your own life? And looking at this idea of despair, why is it that, certain people get consumed by it and others sort of are informed by it and learn from it and grow from it?
Well, that's a great question. So let me start with the good life part, and then I'll go on to the despair. One ingredient of a good life, I think, once again, comes out of Socrates, but you can also find it to some degree in the Buddha. It's that a good life requires one to examine it. It requires one to examine what a good life is. So to live a good life is to, in an ongoing way, in an open-minded way, continue to examine the nature of your life. Now, that might sound a little bit redundant, but something happens when you continue to do it as a daily practice. Your life becomes fuller, it becomes richer, becomes more textured. I think it becomes much more vital. So that's at least one component of a good life, and that's what I've found each and every day. As one person put it, each and every day a philosophical exercise. So each day you're exercising thinking about the kind of life you're living, with the idea of it's becoming more coherent, more intact, more enfleshed, as you continue to do that. That's not all there is to say about the good life. But I think your second question is really interesting to me. Why is it the case that some people fall into despair and other people lift themselves out of it? I don't know that we have a good answer to that, actually. I think it's actually quite a mystery. But what I would say as a partial answer is that you find in there's a wonderful song by Peggy Lee. I just heard it recently. It's called Is That All There Is? She records the song in 1969. And she talks in the song about the loss of a house. Her family's house burns down. She asks, is that all there is? And she goes to the circus, and there's a woman in pink tights, and she thinks, is that all there is? And then she comes to love someone, a young boy, and the boy goes away, and she says, is that all there is? And unfortunately, in the song, she ends up falling into booze, so she goes in for hedonism. But that question is the one that can very much drive some people to continue to investigate why they're here. Mm-hmm. I think also relatedly, the Book of Job, which if your listeners haven't read it, they really should. It's wonderful. It's tragic and it's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's about a man who loses everything he cared about, and he even has to grapple with his faith in the divine, the holy. But it's because he lost everything that he's able to actually go on a journey. So the idea is that his suffering ends up being the force that brings him into conversation with why he's alive, why he exists. Mm-hmm. In answer to your question, I don't know why some people get caught in despair and wallow in it, and why some other people are able to take that despair as a force that leads them on some kind of journey. I think that remains a mystery, but it's certainly a fascinating one.
Well, I think the natural sort of segue from that takes me to that question of happiness and you know, what does it mean to be happy? And why is it that despite everything that we know from, you know, social science and happiness research, of this notion that we think that all these things that we get next, like the next relationship, the next promotion, the next, you know, thing, like when I have this, like, why are we so caught up, even though we know it, I think intellectually, of the that, you know, the if then happiness model is fatally flawed, we still kind of think that, okay, if and when this happens, then I'll be happy. Like, it's still there. You know, like, I know there are certain things in my life where I find that to be true. And what's funny is in those moments that I get those things, I'm like, wow, there's something else now.
So it depends on the view we want to espouse here, and yeah, we can certainly investigate it further. But given that I have both a Socratic background and a Zen Buddhist background, I'll turn to the Zen Buddhist part. The Zen Buddhist would say, well, that's because that's the operation of the ego, which we could examine. Mm-hmm. And the ego is born of lack. It's born of an insufficiency. We'd have to look inside ourselves to see that on this view. We look inside ourselves, perhaps, and say, wow, there is something that's lacking. And out of that lack comes a desire, comes a craving for what it doesn't have. And so when it tries to grab a hold of some object, whatever it may be, whether it's a beloved or a house or a job or whatever, none of those things, according to this account, are actually deep enough to satisfy that longing, that craving, that desire. You don't have to be a Zen Buddhist to analyze the structure of desire. Even Schopenhauer quite nicely put it, he was a pessimist, he quite nicely put it, either it's the case that I get what I desire and I'm bored with it, or it's the case that I don't get what I desire and I'm frustrated and unfulfilled. And, you know, you can think that he was just a pessimist, and indeed he was, but he might have been saying something quite insightful about what it is to be simply a desirous being, to go after that which I do not have. So the idea is that whenever we try to posit or make happiness be something that is an object out there away from us, one that we have to strive for and then grab a hold of, the idea is that that is already bankrupt as a conception of how we can find happiness or be happy.
Well, let's talk about the nature of work in particular, because actually, you know what, before we get to the nature of work, this is something that was on my mind. And as I was looking at your website, it struck me, and it was almost like a sign from the universe, because my friend Mike and I were talking about a particular area of my life that I've been frustrated with. And he said, you look at this as a problem to be solved rather than a process to be enjoyed. And he said, and that's why it's making you so miserable. And I know you had something that said something very similar. And I was very curious to hear about this perspective.
So there are a variety of ways of thinking about situations in life in more neutral or less neutral terms. One way that's become really predominant in Silicon Valley and elsewhere is something I've called the problematization of the world. It's not that one thing or another becomes a problem. It's rather that it becomes a mindset or worldview. That is to say, I begin to look at my life, my relationships, social problems, everything, potentially everything, in terms of problems that need to be solved. When I was trying to research an article that I was writing about it, I couldn't quite find a talk that Elon Musk, who's very good at it, gave. And it was an interesting talk because the interviewer would ask him a question. He'd say, well, that's a problem, and here's how we solved it. And the interviewer would ask him a second question. And here's the problem, and here's how it can be solved. And he's marvelous at it. I'm not disagreeing with his efficacy in terms of problem solving. I was just struck, as we turned to the beginning of our conversation today, by the assumptions that are construed as problems that we go on to solve. And someone might say, well, what's the problem? You know, there's a joke here. What's the problem with that? And we would get into a second order problem solution thinking if I said it was a problem. But if we just look at it a bit, if we take some time with it a bit, then we can see that there is maybe a shortcoming or something that is unfulfilling in that very way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's unfulfilling about it is that it doesn't seem to me, and I doubt it seems to most of us, that in our own experiences, most things really are solvable. I think a good example here would be a marriage. You know, one man said to me, an Argentine CEO said to me recently, well, I'd like to solve my marriage. I'd like to fix my relationship. What if it's the case that relationships aren't really amenable to fixing or to problem solving? What if there's something different altogether? And what goes for relationships may go for all sorts of things. That is, there are all sorts of things in life that seem to be, to use Buddhist terminology, they're impermanent. They come and go. They return. We have to think more about them. They don't really find themselves easily grasped in terms of problems. Mm-hmm. And so I think what your buddy said is likely to be true. If we think of things rather as situations and processes that we're in, then we're much more apt to be able to go along with them in the way that they're actually going along, mm-hmm. rather than thinking that life is going to be good and great and wonderful once this final problem is solved. This returns us in a way to what you're saying about happiness. Mm-hmm. In both cases, there really isn't a sense of finality. Life happens to go on as it goes on. And the question is, are we going to be able to ride along with life as it goes?
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by DesignCrowd. Unmistakable Creative listeners have used DesignCrowd for logo, web, and graphic design. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you set up your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like the designs you get, you can then approve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. To see what other Unmistakable Creative listeners have designed and save $100 on your first project, visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. They host your website and they have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. An easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, one-click WordPress installs, and if you want to switch from an existing host to HostGator, it's free and it's simple. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off.
Why is it that we have a tendency, maybe not all humans are built like this, but I think that some of us are. Why do we tend to cling to things that we've lost? Like, why is it that we have such a hard time from moving on from what we've lost?
Well, I think it's going to depend on what the particular person says. But one of the things we've noticed so far in this conversation is that we've been thinking in the last few questions about our relationship with the future. Mm-hmm. Right? And the idea is that life will only be good when the promise of salvation or the promise of happiness is fulfilled. And the other tendency we have, I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with meditative practice, will be with our relationship with the past. One reason I think we struggle greatly with our relationship with the past is that we thought life was better then. Something that was lost was so deeply important to us that we cling to it. I can think of obviously a grieving and a mourning. Those are clearly examples that come to mind. Yeah. But I can also think of someone who is, I was thinking about someone the other day. She used to always go through memory exercises. When she was thinking to herself, she would commonly recall incidents or episodes from the past. And the reason is that she still held resentments. She still held pains. She still held anger. And the hope was that through memory, she'd be able to figure out what happened and why. So some people say that we have, if we want to go a little bit into psychology here, some people would say, furthermore, that we have emotional pain from early on in our lives, perhaps through upbringing, that has yet to be resolved or worked through, as some might say, or thought out, with the result that we continue to relive those patterns with different people in our lives and in our own mental lives too, even when other people aren't around. So the past has a way of, as Faulkner says, the past has a way of being present, continue to come back to us because we have yet to lay it to rest.
So how do you lay it to rest?
Well, the big thing that I've been doing, there are two things that I do. One is to meditate, and that has a way of really quieting the mind and of allowing us to notice, to come to a kind of awareness in which we aren't a particular thought, we weren't a particular identity. So when you meditate, one of the first things you begin to realize is something that's really quite startling for some people, is that whatever their course of their thoughts is, they are not any of those. We could still need to understand who they are, but certainly they can see that the thought is coming and going, but they are not identical to any of those thoughts. Sam Harris describes this really well in some of his guided meditations. So that's the first thing. It allows us to let go of the past because we realize that whatever that was, whatever that person was, that is not who I am now. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I do often is simply to philosophize. It's interesting to think about, some people will say, this is where I would probably disagree with some people who are involved in meditation, will say, well, you can simply let go of past events by being aware of them and letting them go, just simply by being present. And I think that that's good in some cases, but what about the ones in which things have been really painful for you, really painful for me? When they've been really painful, then I think we need to get to the bottom of them. We need to come to the deepest level of understanding that we can. And what's amazing is that I was having this this conflict the other day with someone, and I was thinking, why is it the case that this is so conflicted? And I, why am I so conflicted about it? And I realized that this person reminded me of the kind of person I used to be. I used to be, before the age of 29, I used to be pretty arrogant, pretty self-conceited. I used to be pretty self-absorbed. I used to think that my intellect made me superior to others. I thought, oh, yes, this is why, after a lot of philosophizing, I thought, oh, yes, this is why I'm so conflicted about this. And once I realized that this person reminded me of the kind of person I really used to be, I was able to then meditate and let go of it. And then I was able to relax. And then I was able to put it to rest. But before then, simply sitting and trying to have a calm mind seemed utterly impossible for me. So those are the two things I tend to do, to meditate and to inquire in such a way as to get to the bottom of things.
Right. Well, let's do this. Let's talk about two things that I think are very relevant to both the world we live in and, our lives. One is work, and the second is money, which are probably kind of both, part of the same coin. I know you have some interesting views on money, so I want to hear about those, because that was something I stumbled up on your site, and I was like, okay, this is something we have to talk about. And then I want to hear about, sort of what are the implications of all of this for the future of work?
Well, the first one, money. So I think we can say, we don't have to get too much into a theory of money, but we can say that money certainly is a, is in one sense, a token of exchange. And so far so good. It's a neutral term there. So when leftists think that money is evil or the root of all evil, we can wonder about whether that's true. And when people on the conservative side think that money can be at the basis of happiness, we can wonder about whether that's true. If we just keep it as a medium of exchange, so far so good. But what I then notice, and this will get us into work, is that people will often say, well, making a living is the same thing as making money. They're identical. And I've heard that from people who are entrepreneurs. I've heard that from people who are artists. I've heard that people who are very open-minded. And that's my first challenge. I think that's a self-evident statement that turns out to be incorrect. There are ways of making a living that go beyond making money.
Mm-hmm.
So it includes making money, but it goes beyond it. I'll just give one example. Right? So we forget that there are plenty of societies that have lived off the land. Even in the 19th century, M.K. Anderson, who's an anthropologist, wrote a book called Tending the Wilds, and she wrote about California, and she says, up until the 19th century, indigenous peoples there had lived, you know, to greater or lesser success off the land. And there are other peoples who have lived off the land itself. So this is one way in which one can actually survive. I use making a living and surviving interchangeably. You can actually provide a model for survival that doesn't involve necessarily making a living. The third way is actually, so the second way we're familiar with, which is using the market in order to make a living, money in that way. The third one is the one that people also don't consider very much. It's almost been lost. This is the one that I have been living in, which is a gift economy. People who live in a gift economy aren't involved in tit-for-tat relationships. They're involved in different kinds of relationships with one another. It's easy when you think about it with regard to a friend. When you go over to a friend's house, you might bring something to the friend, such as a bottle of wine. Now, that's a gift. It's not an exchange. It's not as if he's going to only admit you if you give him the bottle of wine. And he's certainly not going to turn you out if you don't bring the bottle of wine. It's a gift. And there are other sorts of gifts that we give to one another that help us to get by in the world. Friends do each other favors rather than asking for Lyft or calling Uber. People call over friends or babysit for their children when they have to go out last minute. People lend each other things without interest. This might sound a little bit hippie, out there for some of your listeners, but I would submit that this actually still goes on in our lives, and it is in fact to some degree scalable. So if you put those three models together, you find that there are some people who live off the land, so there are eco-villages that are still being tried out today, or those living off the grid. Certainly we can utilize the market transactions in order to produce goods and to offer services. That's fine, so far as that goes. The third way, too, is actually be involved in various thicker, more caring relationships with the people in which we're able to give each other things, words, deeds, perhaps also money, in a way that doesn't circulate in the way that the way the market circulates.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my rather unorthodox view. So remember, the starting point was making a living is identical with making money, and I'm simply arguing that is, and even our mutual friend Kay has said this in a recent post, that is not the entire story, particularly as we move into the 21st century. I can imagine people starting to make a living by utilizing these other models, living more off the land to some degree, maybe selling products or producing services or offering services, and being involved in forms of relationships that are not oriented toward, I give you this and therefore you get that exactly in return, or I do this in equivalently for that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're talking a little bit about artificial intelligence earlier in our conversation, which, you know, has the potential, obviously, to displace you know, millions of jobs, possibly even billions. I mean, I think, you know, we've primarily seen technology be something that displaces blue-collar labor, but what it seems like is coming down the pipe is a large displacement of also white-collar labor. So what does all that mean for, you know, the future of work? What is the definition of work going to be? Like, how is that going to change our relationship to it?
Well, it's an excellent question. I know it's been on a lot of people's minds, and I think the first thing to say is that we certainly don't know, but I'll take a crack at it. I think that some say that AI is going to simply augment human powers. It's going to, and this is the kind of common story we've been told many times, that machine technology will simply augment human powers, freeing us up to do the cognitive and imaginative and creative tasks that we'd like to do otherwise. And some still say that this is going to get rid of a lot of the rote tasks that are basically forms of drudgery. But let's go with the more interesting situation, a more interesting scenario. Suppose it were the case that AI actually does, as you said, replace lots of white-collar jobs. What then? Well, some people are arguing for universal basic income. I think the jury is still out about whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing. But let's suppose that were also implemented and it were enough to meet people's basic needs, material needs. Then I think we have something to grapple with, something that's not often talked about. And this is that I don't know what people would do with their leisure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually quite scary for people. I often hear from people who are COOs or CEOs who are involved in venture capital, and they will say, actually, I'm fine during the weekdays. I'm fine when I'm focused on the tasks at hand and problem solving. It's on the weekends when I start to feel panic, or I start to feel at loss. There's a Latin word that's quite good here, acedia. I start to feel restless in my spirit. I start to feel as if I don't know what to do with myself. Now that's just a weekend, organized according to the very modern idea of a work week and a weekend. But on the supposition that AI were to come to pass and wipe out lots of white-collar jobs, and on the further supposition that UBI were to be passed, I think we have a great existential question on our hands. What would people do with their leisure? How would they actually dwell if they couldn't identify with themselves being a certain kind of worker? That's the question I think is very interesting to me and very alive to. It's the one I'm not really hearing policy experts talk about.
Mm. Wow. Well, I can see why Kay referred to you. This has been really one of those sort of thought-provoking conversations that in so many ways I feel like I'll just have to play back and reflect on, because you've given us a lot to think about. So I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Well, I think it has to do with this is a very American answer. It's a very American answer. I think it has to do with your capacity to leave behind the mainstream, to go your own way, as Frank Sinatra says, I did it my way, to go your own way, and to do something that is unknown to you, and that requires taking a genuine risk, having skin in the game, and acting courageously, not knowing what's going to come out of it. And being able to return to conventions in the mainstream, either way, whether you've succeeded or whether you haven't succeeded, being able to return to mainstream society and think, I have no regrets.
Hmm. Wow. Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
They can find out more about me by visiting my website, which is andrewjtaggart.com, or you can just Google my name and also include philosopher so that you don't confuse me with a singer.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah. When I got the Google search as well. So awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.